You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, Fairfield, Iowa.
I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with my co-host Alan Cobb, and this is Icon Art Radio. We've invited back our guest of last week, Michael Rutherford, because after recording the show, we got talking, and we thought that we should talk about all this stuff on the radio so that listeners could hear. Just start talking. It was interesting. You were starting to describe your experience at the studio at Icon when you were painting one day.
Yeah, I was told that I should just bring my paint on a Saturday and show up because there are other people that will go there to paint and paint together. And it was really quiet in there. And you know, nobody's talking, everybody's working. And so I asked one of the guys next to me, I said, so whose music do you like better? Or whose writing do you like better is what it was. Do you prefer better? Because I know everybody likes these guys quite a bit. Who do you like, who do you prefer better? Who's writing, McCartney or Lennon? Because everybody in the room was from a generation prior to mine. And I knew this would get them talking. And sure enough, doggone it, it did. Everybody started talking about their favorite Beatles song.
Right.
It was just amazing. And so it was just the best time painting at Icon with everybody. And we were talking about, you know, the Beatles. Because I grew up listening to my mom's records. She had the Beatles. She had Johnny Cash. She had Elvis, of course. And just listening to all that stuff, it was just awesome. And then to talk with others about it who actually lived in that time period, to try to pick up, okay, what was the vibe of the time like? I learned a lot that way.
Yeah, that's a heck of a topic for a conversation.
You've got two people here. They could go right there.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting time.
What I like, last week in the show, we talked about this correspondence between experiences of music and visual art, and that an artist really could pick up almost any avenue of expression, any media, and start talking about his poetic soul. So we're always looping as artists between all these experiences of the senses that contain depth. And then we talk about them a little bit, and that makes us an artist. And so it's interesting to hear you talk about music in this way and music being as meaningful to you. Do you make music at all?
No, I don't. I was in the drum corps in high school, but I don't set out to make music. Although I did a story, I've got a blog called paintersbread.com that I blog about art on, and I did a story on this really interesting folk phenomenon that's occurring right now. It's been occurring for the past few years, and that is cigar box guitars. And there are guys out there.
This is going on right now. People are making cigars.
Yes. Big time. And it's getting bigger all the time. I did a story on this phenomenon, cigar box guitars, where these guys take any cigar box. It could be cardboard. It could be the wooden, more sturdy ones. And they're making a guitar. And it's usually a slide guitar. And they use a little electronic element that you can buy at Radio Shack for $5, and they electrify this thing and they sound great, and they're doing this bluesy slide guitar music with these cigar box guitars. And the trick of it is to use as many found materials as you can that are interesting to make the cigar box guitar unique. So they'll use some weird big old button for a knob, or something, an old screw for a tuning peg, and It's really...
So the visual of it is a significant piece of folk art.
It is. And, you know, that's one other interesting area that I've just stumbled across.
So is this guy local that you interviewed? That's doing?
I just did a story on the phenomenon itself.
Oh. Now,
I had stumbled on a website called Cigar Box Nation. And Cigar Box Nation is one of those websites where if you make one of these things, you can take a picture of it and send it in to this website, Cigar Box Nation, and they'll put it on there. So there's all these people just chiming in and putting in their 2 cents worth of what they've made. It's really interesting
to have an exhibit of them.
Yeah. Well, the whole notion of folk music is, you know, again, there's kind of a historical meaning to the idea of folk music, and, you know, folkways records and all the classic recordings that were made primarily to preserve the art form. But then there's contemporary folk music, which people don't call folk music. And yet it's what you do on the front porch with your neighbors. And if you happen to live in Harlem, what you do on the front porch with your neighbors might be rap or hip hop or something. And then there are people who've gotten electronic instruments and personal computers, and they do stuff at home without formal training, the same way that, you know, the guy sitting on the porch in Appalachia did, 75 years ago. And it's no less folk music just because it's made with, you know, very high-tech equipment. It's still made by folk. You know, and it deserves that kind of attention. I've been very, very excited just as a composer thinking about how the tools are now available for everybody to be a composer and for everybody to write music and make music, and with more skill or less skill. Obviously, if you're classically trained, you can sit down at any keyboard, synthesizer, or Steinway, and play great music that was composed, you know, in whatever era appeals to you. But there's another way of accessing music now that doesn't require you to have that much skill. And that doesn't make it any less music, and it doesn't make it any less art, or any less valid in any sense. It's simply different. This is another area where, you know, people start pulling things in from other fields, and it's kind of a synesthetic process where you start using visual art forms to express sonic experiences and vice versa.
I know I like to look at things, as I've said before, from a cross-discipline approach. Another thing that really took me by surprise was the philosophy and mode that professional skateboarders get into, their perspective. And a big saying amongst professional skateboards is, skate how you feel, not how you should. And, you know, that's another one of those little juicy tidbit things that it's like, you know, something you've seen on a bumper sticker that just hits you. And that I've carried with me a little bit. I've been informed by that saying, do this, do it how you feel, not how you think you should or how you think other people think you ought to do it. And, you know, that's really kind of a freeing moment when you look at whatever activity you're involved in. If you're trying to progress, to try to do things not so much how you've learned or the institutional has taught you it should be done, but how you feel more.
Absolutely.
Well, we often talk about how, in a sense, the process of art is the process of getting out of your own way. And I think that's a good example of, you know, the first layers of ways that we get in our own way come from worrying about what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to approach it. What am I supposed to say about this? And will I be able to defend it if somebody says, what on earth are you doing? And, you know, does it involve enough skill in some category to command respect from people who are going to judge it on the basis of craftsmanship and don't care at all about whether it moves them? Or people who are legitimately moved by craftsmanship and don't care at all about what the object is. You know, there's a full spectrum in an infinite number of dimensions. But it's the process of freeing oneself from all of that that reveals the possibility that you can actually still do things even when you're not trying.
And with professional skateboarders, there is a certain amount of pressure put on them by their sponsors to keep performing and doing the same set of tricks every time, because the people want to see it, the audience is out there. They really do push for personal progression. That's what a professional skateboarder lives for. And so that personal progression and that way of looking at things, the perspective that a professional skateboarder takes, really, when you look at some of the professional artists that are out there in the gallery scene, sometimes they have some amount of pressure put on by this such and such large gallery to keep on making, you know, that one type of painting or yeah. one type of sculpture or whatever.
We have a standing joke on the show that when an artist begins to become recognized by a gallery, sooner or later they have to confront the situation of paint more blue ones. Some gallery owner says, you know, these are the ones that people want to buy, so you should do more of them. Without any regard for the fact that the artist may have gotten sick of doing blue ones 10 years ago and hasn't even considered doing a blue one since then and isn't even working in the same medium anymore. But it becomes a temptation, because if you're selling art, then you're trying to live off of sales, then you have that terrible dilemma of which force to succumb to.
And there's always this tension
between
the marketing side of the thing and the artist's need for self-discovery. And
it's inevitable.
You have to find this balance. And usually artists sort of like cave a bit, and they end up enjoying having a reputation for making a certain kind of thing for the rest of their lives and making tons of money, some, very few. tons of money,
right.
Or you make enough to put your roof over your family and to buy food and send your kids to school, and those are good things, but sometimes the art suffers because of that, so it's a tension that goes on. Yeah. The art gallery wants you to change enough so that they want to buy more new ones, but they don't want you to change your style so that it's not a recognizable Rutherford.
Yeah, recognizability is marketable.
Because they've spent a lot of money, you know, marketing your reputation and style. So it's a tension that goes on.
Right.
And if you can come to this level of freedom that you've just been describing, you have to work there, otherwise you'll just dry up as an artist. You can forget that you're an artist and figure that you're a manufacturer of objects to make money or to make, you know, but you get, this is very mixed, but it kind of gets that way. But that inner deep core of the true artist only can be nourished by discovering deeper realms and bringing them out, and you don't know where that's going to take you. So as we were saying earlier, every artist who has ever really taken the course of the history of art and then given it a new direction has come to this point. And they just follow their feelings and their needs as an artist. And sometimes everybody else comes along, sometimes everybody doesn't, but it doesn't matter to you right. because that's your work.
It may take a generation or two right. for people to realize that you're not just messing around.
I think a lot of times, ultimately, a person gets to the point where they ask themselves, why am I making these things that I'm making? Why this way and not that way? Why am I influenced by this or that? And where is my own work going or progressing to? I think that once a person gets to that point, that's when things start to get interesting, because you're getting honest with yourself about your work. You're finally getting down to the gut feelings of why you're making something.
Yeah, our art becomes a means to a greater end. It's not the production of art objects, it's the self-discovery.
And I know...
And it's really hard to put your finger on what that is any more than trying to define life itself.
And I got to bring up a local favorite, and that's Jim Shrosbury. If there's anybody that's you know, out there doing his own thing, it's Jim.
He's an inspiration to us, and he's one person that's in our region that's very famous, quite well known. And his objects have just gotten better and better because of it's obvious that he's giving himself permission to go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, when I first saw his work and how he was pulling in, you know, different elements
Well, you guys have a correspondence for sure.
He's been like my, you know, kind of an inspiration to me, big time. And the fact that, you know, he's so local and very accessible. I was able to interview him for the blog, Painter's Bread, and that was just an experience I'll always remember. Interviewing an artist in his studio, seeing his environment, and getting to visit with him with what he's all about, and then his work too. Getting to actually interview him at length, to a certain extent, about his own work.
That must be fulfilling. And so, let's say a word or two about the Painter's Bread. How were you inspired to do Painter's Bread? This is a blog he created, and he's interviewed numerous artists. What inspired you to do this? And say a few words about it.
Well, for quite some time before I had started Painter's Bread, I had been inspired to start a blog by seeing other bloggers out there and all the different blogs, and they all have unique names. And I thought for quite some time about, okay, what am I going to name this blog? Because I want it to mean something to me, and I want other people to get it. And my family and I went to St. Louis on a vacation, and I had never been to a soul food restaurant. So I said, I did the research, and I said, I'm going to go to a soul food restaurant. I called this place up. It was the Delmonico Diner in St. Louis. And when we got there, it was totally different culture. We walked in, and the people there, you know, were like, hey, where are you from? And I said, well, we're from Iowa. We called last week. And she said, oh, you guys are those folks from Iowa. And they asked us where we were from, and we had a great home-cooked meal, basically, is what soul food is. So I wanted the website to be about that thing that enriches us, food, a little bit, in the name. I kind of look at art as that soul food that keeps sustaining us. And so I wanted to pull in, have a little bit of a tie-in. So that's why I thought about the name for a year before I came up with the blog. And that's how I decided upon Painter's Bread, and just been having a ball with it ever since, just kind of doing it when I get time. And also started a subsidiary site just a week ago, It's the sidekick to Painter's Bread. And this is a website where it won't just focus on painting. It'll be focused on all kinds of art and more edgy art. And the title of that one is Postmodern Toaster. And underneath the title, when you go there, it'll say A Visual Machine. And every blog has an archive, and the blog archive is called the Crumb Tray. And so I've got different, it's a kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but cool. But kind of going that place with it.
Can I go there now?
Yeah, you sure can.
Okay.
You bet.
So tell, for the listening audience, the URLs of these blogs.
Okay, www.paintersbread.com, the sidekick site to paintersbread.com is postmoderntoaster.blogspot.com. And so go there and you'll see some
different work. I can't wait to check it out. What are some of the artists in the region that you've interviewed?
Interviewed, of course, Jim Shrosbury. Let me see here. Ananda Kessler from Fairfield. Those are just two of the locals. Also interviewed from Iowa City, a professor at U of I, Sue Hetmansperger. And she's been at U of I many years, well-known, and just a great mentor to many of the painters. One of her students that I interviewed was, let's see here. This is where you're going to have to cut this out until I remember his name. Jared Sprecher. And Jared is a painter that he now teaches at UT, University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And let's see, interviewed a few other artists, even just by email. Never met these folks. I just send them emails and asked if they'd want to do an email interview. And they send me the JPEGs via email. And they're more than happy to have their work shown in another venue out there to try to help promote their work also. But you know, when I see an artist that I like, I just want to tell other people about them, and I think that's just one way.
I think what you're doing is fantastic, in that we live in an age where we have the technology and the means and to establish this kind of connectedness just through our own.
Well, and the internet is such a vast, I don't want to say wasteland, but it's such a vast, chaotic field of input that curation is one of the most important things you can do on the internet, is to select the stuff that's worth taking a second look at and elevate it a little bit from the noise floor.
It's been a ball. I chose a bunch of artists and actually contacted the galleries for permission to put their work on my blog, to show their work on it. And I think I had three of them that I had shown ended up, you know, being picked for another major venue somewhere else. And that was kind of inspiring to see that somebody else liked them too. It was like, wow, you know, I just thought that was kind of neat anyway. But that aspect of having stuff just shooting all over the world, you know, on somebody else's screen miles and miles away, that's I don't know, it's just something to think about.
It's a new intimacy that we have, and it's quite an amazing, I never could have seen it coming.
This radio show is accessed by people in more than 60 countries around the world.
Our little beam only goes about a mile beyond Fairfield.
Yeah, you can't pick it up in Packwood.
Streaming is, we have people listening to our show in Australia and in California.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Now, I guess in some ways, you know, the internet's opened up, you know, more venues for people to see art by just their own screen, millions of screens, you know.
Well, it's changed my art cruising completely.
Oh, yeah.
I used to have to look in the LA Times and figure out what galleries I was going to go check out today. And then you go drive in your car, and then you walk on the La Brea or La Cienega or down in Melrose or something, and we're out in Beverly Hills, and you got to drive to each place. You got to get out. You got to check out each gallery. And you walk in, you take one look, and you think, oh, no, I'll take that back. I don't recommend, you know, making a snap judgment about somebody's work, but sometimes you know you're in the wrong place. But you can surf on the internet and just enrich yourself in an hour of stuff going on all over the world. It's amazing.
Yeah, more and more galleries are recognizing that part of their role is to be visible beyond the front door. Hopefully they all will.
So I didn't, in the middle of the show, we got talking so much, I didn't let people who tuned in the middle know who we're talking to. This is Michael Rutherford, who's part of a group show at Icon Gallery in Fairfield through January 21st, 2012, and it's been great talking to you. Do you have any final bit of knowledge that we can carry away with us about such things as the freedom idea that you brought out? Let's have a parting shot.
Okay.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
That's all right.
You didn't mean to, but you did.
Start digging in my gray matter here.
I'll come up with a parting shot if you don't.
I can always come up with a parting shot. Yes, I have a infinite supply.
I think I got
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, there you go.
That's true. Happy holidays.
Oh, the only thing I can say is work comes out of work. Work how you feel, not how you should.
There you go. Thank you so much.
Words from the skateboard kings.
Those guys can flip a board around and be philosophical at the same time.
Michael's on our Icon board, and we need to talk about all this stuff you brought up. There's a show in this. Skateboards, banjos, you know, the banjo, guitar, banjo. Yeah.
There's some major artists that are doing skateboard decks.
I know. I mean, this has opened up a whole new avenue for me to think about.
Okay.
So thanks for doing that. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.